Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Reed Elkis, registration number 32516, and I represent the appellants in this case. And Your Honors, the legal question before this court is whether the appellants were acting within the course and scope of their employment as law enforcement officers when the appellants published a report to Commerce City City Management. If you find that the trial court was in error in making that determination, then the appellants were provided sovereign immunity under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. And so I just briefly for the court, I want to summarize what this oral argument is going to entail. The trial court misapplied the holding in pediatric neurosurgery case as well as the Potboy case. And next, I would like to talk about how the trial court misconstrued the collective bargaining agreement. And finally, I'm going to talk about the various serious public policy concerns as a result of the court's order in this case. But first, let's talk about the scope of employment issues. Pursuant to pediatric neurosurgery versus Russell, an employee is within the course and scope of their employment if the work is done, number one, assigned by the employer, is necessarily incidental to that work, or is customary in the employer's business. Now, at a minimum, the content of the subject letter in this case, when published to the city manager or city manager of the Commerce City, it was necessarily incidental to law enforcement work as well as customary in law enforcement activity. And how do we know this, Your Honors? Well, first, the letter discusses ethical concerns of the chief of police. The letter discusses departmental policy violations as committed by administration. The letter discusses morale within the police department. And most importantly, the letter discusses and reveals criminal behavior as purportedly committed by command staff. In fact, during the Trinity hearing, ex-chief Kevin Saunier, Karen Stevens, the assistant city attorney, as well as Chief Phil Baca, all said that law enforcement officers have a duty to report crimes. Chief Baca even went further, Your Honors, even stating that officers have a duty to follow their own policies. So taking the Russell decision, based on the four examples alone that I just presented to the court, the substance of the letter, when published, was necessarily incidental to law enforcement, as well as customary in law enforcement activity. In fact, the court, and I believe it was on page 13 of the decision, even stated that their actions, that the appellant's actions were collateral to their role as law enforcement officers. Now, I understand that neurosurgery doesn't say the word collateral, but certainly I think this court can infer when we talk about collateral, we're talking about incidental.
Well, counsel, as I understand your brief, you seem to admit that at least part of what was going on in the communications were union activity, the letter that was sent. You argue that in essence this is sort of a combination situation, a hybrid situation, where part of it was related to law enforcement and part of it was related to union activity. If that's the case, then doesn't that support the trial court's ruling that it was union activity? And if given our standard that we have to review the case under, doesn't that compel us to affirm the trial court's decision?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think the answer is no. And here's why. The issue that sort of gave the appearance that it was union activity is that the document, the substance of the letter, it was on an FOP letterhead, right? And it was signed by the president of the union. So the form of the letter looks like it was a union letter. And yes, presumably the birth of this letter occurred in the union halls, but the analysis cannot end there. The analysis has to go further, like in Podboy. Because in FOP versus Podboy, we looked at the content, or the Court of Appeals looked at the content, and what was the intent of disseminating that publication of Podboy? And what was the intent with the publication of this letter? So you have to go beyond the more form of it. You need to go to the substance, Your Honor. And when we look at the substance of the letter, it is not union activity. The substance of the letter is necessarily incidental to law enforcement. And how do we know that, Your Honor? If you read the 23 pages, and you have to, you got to read all 23 pages to figure out what really is this. Is this union activity? Are we talking about pay wages, compensation, overtime? No.
But some of it is about terms of employment, right?
That. I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
Wouldn't you agree with that? Some of it is how the command structure is treating the officers.
Well, the way that the letter does say that, but you cannot look at that letter in a vacuum. You have to compare it to the collective bargaining agreement. Because the collective bargaining agreement is essentially the contract. It is the document that between the union and the city that says, okay, union, this is what you could talk about. And what you could talk about is wages. What you could talk about is benefits, pay, compensation, vacation. It doesn't talk about the ability to talk about malfeasance, corruption, and criminal behavior. That's outside the four corners of a collective bargaining agreement. So when you look outside the four corners of the collective bargaining agreement and you look at these appellants, what are they voicing? What are they telling city management? What they're telling city management is, look, the chief of police is engaged in corruption. His administration is engaged in criminal behavior. And as law enforcement officers, that is their duty. It is necessarily incidental and customary in the work environment of law enforcement officers to report corruption, malfeasance, and criminal behavior. And if you look at that document even further, Your Honor, you will see they talk about departmental policy violations. They talk about ethic concerns. And that clearly is outside the four corners of the collective bargaining agreement.
So I'd like to pursue a little bit the legal test that we're supposed to apply here. If you look at the specific language of that test coming out of the Supreme Court's opinion in Moses and in the Podboy opinion, it really seems to have at least two or three elements. One is employees act within the scope of their employment if they perform work that their employer has assigned to them. You didn't talk about that one. The trial court made a finding that writing this letter was not assigned to them by their police supervisors. But then the next one reads, if they engage in tasks that are necessarily incidental to such work, does the term such work mean that it has to be tasks assigned to them by their employer? Because if it does, then how can you argue the necessarily incidental part of that test?
And how I read it, as I see the test, Your Honor, comes from the pediatric neurosurgery versus Russell, and how I read the three elements, assigned by employer, is necessarily incidental to that work, or is customary in the employer's business, I think those are all ors, Your Honor. I don't think you have to find that it was assigned by the employer. I think if you find that it was assigned by the employer, okay. Or you could find that, is it necessary incidental to that work? Or is it customary in the employer's business? As made by the trial court, I think the trial court found that it was not assigned by the employer. So that's a finding of fact that Your Honors will have to accept. But what the trial court did not find, and I think just trying to answer in this sort of roundabout way, is that the trial court should have gone on further and said, or was it incidental to that work, or was it customary in the workplace?
But if the task that we're talking about here is writing the letter, how is writing the letter necessarily incidental to the work that is normally performed by these police officers?
And I think, Your Honor, I think that's maybe where the confusion lies, because you have to go further than that. You cannot just sit there and say, okay, they drafted a letter, and let's say they drafted a letter based on the authority given to them in the union halls. That's not enough. You have to say, okay, so they disseminated the letter, and what were they disseminating? You know, what was the substance of that letter? It was like the Podboy case. Because in Podboy, what ended up happening was that you had the union who, I think the issue that the court took was it in the best interest for the union? Is that why they did it? Because I don't think the bright line law, the bright line rule should be, because it was union activity, then we're done. Because it appears like it's union activity, it's done. There needs to be a further analysis that's involved. And the further analysis that needs to be done is, what were they trying to convey? And I actually think that's in accordance with Podboy. Because Podboy, in that particular case, you had a Denver deputy sheriff that says, okay, I have a debate with two unions here, the Denver Sheriff's Union and the FOP, and what we're arguing is about collective bargaining. And in that particular case, Chuck DeNovelis, he submitted or disseminated in the Denver Sheriff Department a publication, a defamatory statement. There, the court said, well, that was strictly about collective bargaining, and that was strictly in the best interest for the union. Here, we have to look more than that. We can't just say, okay, this is drafted in the union halls, but what were they trying to convey? Why were they conveying it? And when you look, as I explained to Judge Terry, when you look at the substance of the document, you're going to see it really is more than just union activity. Because you can't just have a bright line rule that says, all right, because it looks like a union, it's got to be a union. Because it's on union letterhead, it's got to be a union.
Well, but what I hear you saying is that you would have a bright line rule that if it has anything having to do with law enforcement in it, then it's not subject, that it's not subject to the test.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm not saying that because I think this is where I took issue with the trial court. So let's give an example. Let's say the trial court says, I draft a report, a police report, okay, and it's on the City of Commerce City police report, and it's signed Officer Smith, here's my badge number. Okay, but the content of it is all about collective bargaining. It's all about, I want to submit this almost like for an arbitration. So when you look at it, okay, well, it looks like it's coming from the police, and it's signed by the police. Does that mean it's a public employee? I think the answer is probably not. You have to go a little further than that. And I think that's my issue. My issue is when you look at the document, okay, it sort of looks like it's union activity. And I'll concede, it does look like it's union activity, but you have to read it. And I think the bright line rule is we need to see what was to be communicated. We need to see what was the intent of the parties. We need to see what the substance of the communication is. And when you look at the substance of the communication, is public employees.
Pardon me, I want to ask you a question before you run out of time here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
My concern here is what we're reviewing, and my concern is that there are a couple of findings of fact that the trial court made. And obviously, you dispute these findings, I understand that, but we've got a fairly limited standard of review on those things. So, what are we supposed to do if there's evidence in the record to support these findings of fact, and specifically the trial court's findings that your clients were acting in a capacity of collective bargaining agents, not city employees, and they wrote the letter with regard to violations of the collective bargaining agreement? I understand that you can point to stuff in the letter that you say is outside the collective bargaining agreement, but you've just conceded that there's stuff in the letter that is clearly union-oriented. I mean, for example, they talk about 19 violations of the FOB contract, and that's just one. So where are we now if these factual findings have support? Don't we have to defer to them?
Well, let me back up a little bit, Your Honor. I only have very brief time here. We're not conceding that the information in there is part of the collective bargaining agreement. What they identified in the letter was examples of how the chief of police ignored various aspects or his leadership runs afoul of his obligations as chief of police. With that being said, with regard to your comments about giving deference to the trial court's finding of facts, absolutely. I understand that the standard is clearly erroneous, but what you can do, Your Honors, is take those findings of fact and apply them de novo. And when you apply it de novo, you will find that the trial court erred as a matter of law. And how did the trial court err as a matter of law? The trial court erred as a matter of law with the analysis of the collective bargaining agreement, specifically under Article 6 and Article 7. The trial court's application of those findings of fact to the application of contract is completely wrong as a matter of law, and you, Your Honors, can actually review those findings of fact and make a determination that the contract interpretation by the court was in error as a matter of law. With respect to those findings of fact about specific, whether within the course and scope of their employment, you, Your Honors, de novo, make a legal determination that what they were doing was within the scope of their employment. So you can take those findings of fact, and I think you can take those findings of fact and make the legal conclusion where the court erred that these individual appellants were acting within the course and scope of their employment and are entitled to sovereign immunity, Your Honors. Now, I only have 1 minute left, Your Honors, and I guess at this point, I'd like to see if I can reserve the remaining part of my time for rebuttal.
Absolutely. Thank you, Your Honor. So you've got a little over 1 minute left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, John McHenry, registration number 1209, on behalf of Mr. Cuppage, the appellee. The issues here, Your Honor, stem on whether or not there is substantial evidence in the record that would warrant and justify setting aside the findings of fact and conclusions of law of the trial court. What are those substantial factors raised by the appellant? They disagree with the court's analysis of the FOP document, yet they acknowledge the FOP document, as the court found, was drafted as a result of a membership meeting in October of 2013, published to the city at a firehouse meeting, and thereafter at a meeting of December 5, and yet the president of the local, Mr. Harris, who signed the document, with the words "in representation of the membership" at page 23 of the FOP document, testifies that it was prepared as a result of a direction from the police chief.
So let me just stop you right there, because so that's how the document, the letter is signed. But in one section of the letter, it says that it's summarizing questions and concerns that we, the authors, have as membership of the FOP. That's one thing. But then it goes on to say that these are questions and concerns that we have as employees of the city of Commerce City. So doesn't that seem to indicate that they're writing this letter at least in part as employees rather than as representatives of the union?
It does not, because the procedures that the police follow in bringing criminal complaints to the attention of law enforcement is through the process under the rules of criminal procedure. The process that employees would follow, as indicated by the evidence in this case, for policy violations is to bring it to the attention of the relevant people in the human resources division or department of the company. But this is a union membership generated document for union purposes, and my colleague's reference to the collective bargaining agreement is not a complete reference to the evidence that needs to be examined. The scope of the obligation of the city to recognize the union is set forth in the city charter. The obligation of the city to deal and meet with the union and the union's reciprocal obligation is described in the constitution of the union, and the FOP document is inherently consistent with the representational responsibility that the union would have. So, what is the rationale for setting aside the findings of fact of the trial court? What is the substantial evidence that separates both sides?
Pardon me, counsel, before you move on to that point, you made a point about how these employees would have brought to someone's attention if there actually was criminal activity.
Sure.
But, and I'm not sure I heard the punchline to that. What is the correct procedure that they would follow,
if not
to do a letter such as the one they did?
File a criminal complaint.
To file
or bring it to the attention of the appropriate law enforcement lawyers, either city.
So in other words, bring it to the district attorney?
Yes, ma'am.
And allow the district attorney to take it or not.
Correct.
Take any actions that might be taken.
Correct. There's no probable cause that's associated with the process of writing what we would respectfully claim is a defamatory document and publishing it. There's no reasonable cause to determine whether or not there's any accuracy in the document and the process that was followed by the appellants. What they did was publish this document, and some of them admitted either they didn't read it, and none of them could testify they investigated to determine whether or not there was any truth to the facts set forth in the document they published.
But doesn't that go to the merits of the defamation claim itself rather than to the immunity issue?
No, with all due respect, Your Honor, I believe it goes to both. Of course it goes to the merits. Of course it goes to the question of whether or not there was willful or wanton conduct, which is another issue pending before the court. But the issue, it also goes to the question of whether or not the document was a bona fide law enforcement document or was in fact a union gripe, which with clear understanding since the Connally decision of the U.S. Supreme Court 50 years ago is part and parcel of a continuing bargaining process that goes on between unions and management. And this document was plainly designed, as the court noted, to get rid of Chief Baca. And Chief Baca testified clearly that he did not direct that the document be prepared. The evidence is also apparently undisputed, if I understood my colleague's argument correctly, that the document was prepared at a membership meeting in October of 2013. All of that is not indicia of law enforcement. That is indicia of union gripes and grievances and desires being brought to the attention of the management of the city. And where did it go first? An important fact, I think, that supports the conclusions of law of this court. It didn't go back to the chief, as my colleague would claim, directed it be prepared, even though the chief denied that it issued such directive. It went to the mayor. It went to the city manager. It went to people who were not involved in the law enforcement process, but are involved in the collective bargaining process and the process designed to deal with the relationship between the parties on an ongoing basis.
Let me ask a question. Does the record indicate at all how the letter ended up in the hands of the Denver Post? And if so, what is the relevance, if any, of that to the immunity issue?
I believe it is not relevant to the immunity issue. The question of the immunity issue under my reading of the statute and the law is pretty clear. And I think Potboy is the case. I would encourage you all to examine closely on this point, is that if they were performing functions in accordance with the duties and responsibilities of law enforcement, if it was part of their responsibility to do so, it doesn't matter where it's published. That is, as an old plaintiff's lawyer in this area, an unhappy circumstance of the law, but it is nevertheless the law. It got to the Denver Post because word, for some reason, got out, and the Denver Post sent an FOIA request for the document. So when it was released to the Denver Post, it was simultaneously posted on the city's website. However, that does go to the issue of damages later on, of course, because any publisher of defamation in a municipal or other government knows there's always a chance that there'll be requests for it to be made public. But that's not the sole reason for the underlying litigation. Finally, I would like to comment upon the unique situation we find ourselves in. The court has already ruled, relying on Podboy, that neither the Union Lodge 19 or the State Lodge are immune. The publishers of the defamation, my colleague assert, are immune. I think that flies in the face of the resolution of the issues on the motion for dismissal. And I would respectfully suggest the court examine both decisions in rendering the determination of whether or not there is substantial evidence in this record that would set aside the conclusions of this trial court. And the fact that the court did not, as my colleagues suggest, examine the entire record of the document, including the parts they would believe you should seize upon to set aside this jurisdictional motion. The jurisdictional facts here are plain, that the court examined the entire document. And if you examine the briefs of the parties, you will note that portions of the entire document were relied upon by the trial court that were not argued by either myself on behalf of Mr. Cubbage or Mr. Elkis on behalf of his client, thus showing that the whole document was examined and considered. What is the evidence, other than their difference of opinion about the court's decision, that would warrant substantial evidence setting aside the decision. Unless there's any further questions, I've concluded my argument.
Thank you very much, Mr. McKendry.
Thank you, John.
Mr. Elkins, you've got a little over a minute for rebuttal.
The final issue I want to raise before this court, Your Honors, is the public policy concerns. Public employees do not give up their immunity under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act merely because they're members of a union or a collective group. If this court upholds the trial court's ruling, it will create a public policy concern of law enforcement officers not reporting acts of corruption and criminal behavior. Certainly, the public has an interest in having law enforcement officers eliminate corruption and criminal behavior in their departments. However, if officers are considered individuals and not public employees when making such reports, then you will likely see officers electing not to report the corruption. In other words, there's going to be a chilling effect, and that will fly in the face of the policy behind the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. And I'm going to finish it off with what the policy says under the CJIA. It is also recognized that public employees, whether elected or appointed, should be provided with protection from unlimited liability so that such public employees are not discouraged from providing the services or functions required by the citizens or from exercising the powers authorized or required by law. Colorado Revised Statute 24-10-102. In light of the foregoing, Your Honors, we would ask that you find that these appellants are provided Colorado governmental immunity. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Elkins. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. At this point in time,